Top, at the very top of Yud Aleph, Amid Aleph. Now, remember the problem here. The problem we're dealing with is, in order to be able to slaughter birds from the dovecots on Yom Tov, you have to pre-designate the birds before Yom Tov that you want to use. Otherwise, the birds are considered muktzah. They're not in a state of readiness, and therefore they cannot be used. Do we have the other Gemaras looking for a Gemara? Give me on the shelf. The Mishnah gave us a case. This is the very top line. The Teicha came. I prepared birds that were within the nest. I designated two birds in the nest. Umatza lifnei came. And the next day, on Yom Tov, I find them on the ledge in front of the nest. In other words, there are no birds in the nest, and I find the birds in front of the nest. Now, there are a few possibilities. Maybe they are the same birds in the nest that hopped outside, in which case they would be good. Or maybe they're birds that came elsewhere, and the birds that were in the nest flew away. Right, that's the question. In other words, two birds in the nest, and you find two birds out of the nest.
Actually, they hop out because, you know...
They hop out, yeah, because they're not flying birds. So the Mishnah says they are forbidden, because we are choshesh that these are birds that come from the outside. That's what the Mishnah seems to say. So the Gemara now brings in that this too seems to be proof of a shaila that we raised. Lema misayele l'Rabbi Chanina. Should we say that this is a proof to Rabbi Chanina? D'yama Rabbi Chanina, rov v'karav halech acharav. Remember, we mentioned this shaila before, and the Gemara is using this part of the Mishnah to address it. Rov v'karav, right? Let's assume that a majority of your stores are kosher meat stores. And normally, if you find a piece of meat and you don't know if it comes from the majority element or the minority element, the halacha is you assume that it comes from the majority. But what if it's closer to the minority element? 9 kosher, 1 treif, you find the meat closer to the treif. Now, on one hand, the normal probability is, if it's a 9-to-1 chance, that it's kosher rather than treif. On the other hand, probabilities are greatly increased in the other direction when you have proximity. Or, and it could be vice versa as well, 9 treif and 1 kosher, and you find it nearest to the kosher. So Rabbi Chanina raises the question, if you have the principle of rov, which is majority, and it conflicts with the principle of karov, which is proximity, is majority a stronger principle than proximity? Rabbi Chanina argues majority wins. Majority trumps proximity. Now, he's an Amora. Now, the Gemara is suggesting perhaps we could prove that from our Mishnah itself. Because here we have a nest that had two birds in it, and then you have the big wide world that has gazillions of birds in it, and now we have a ledge, and we find two birds on the ledge. Now, maybe the two birds came from the majority of the birds in the world that are not prepared, or maybe they came from the proximity of the two birds in the nest. The Mishnah that tells me I got to be strict, because I have to assume that they come from the wild blue yonder, even though the closest birds to this ledge were the ones in the nest. So the Mishnah itself, in other words, seems to follow the rule of Rabbi Chanina, that proximity versus the majority, you follow the principle of majority. In other words, which is actually very good, meaning the word wants to know, is Rabbi Chanina's rule provable from the Mishnaic ruling? So this is a hypothesis. Should we say that this proves it? So Abaya says no. Now, we do paskin, like, in point of fact, Rabbi Hanin is correct, but all we're saying is the Mishnah is not a proof. And we give two answers why that is so. Answer number one is, Amar Abaya Bedaf, the word daf, which we use to mean a page, also means a ledge. That the point is, we had this answer before as well, that we're talking about a ledge in which birds from all over frequently congregate. So consequently, the following. It's not that our choice is, did the birds on the ledge come from inside, or did they come from the wild blue yonder? Rather, did the birds on the ledge come from the inside, or from the group of birds that normally comes on the ledge, which actually is even closer to where I find these birds than the nest? So this is not an example of proximity which contradicts majority. This is an example where the majority element of non-prepared birds are both proximate and numerically larger, and therefore it's obvious we will follow that. In other words, Rov versus Karov, that's a question. But if something is both numerically larger and proximate, then for sure that will be good. That's Abaya's answer why the Mishnah is not a proof. Rava gives a whole different case to the Mishnah. And let's first see what Rava's case is, and then we'll see how it addresses Rabbi Hanina's problem. Again, what is the bare-bones statement in the Mishnah? The bare-bones statement is, you prepared two birds in the nest, and the next morning you found two birds sitting outside of the nest on a ledge. So the Mishnah says, you're forbidden to shech them. So listen how Rava adds something to the case. The Mishnah is talking about Bishnei Kinin, two birds' nests, Zu Lamala Mizu Es Kinin. The case was, imagine a two-story dovecot. On the second story there are two birds, and on the first story there are two birds. The next morning you come, and there are no birds in either nest, meaning there's nothing in the top nest, nothing in the bottom, but there are two outside. Now, let's assume you were Mazmin, the bottom one. It's possible the two outside come from the bottom, or it's possible the two outside come from the top. But here, Rava's argument is that the very fact that the top nest is emptied out lends credence to the fact that this may be the pair that came, meaning it's not just birds from the outside. Here, there's a particular reason to connect it to that. And he says the following, V'lo mi boy, it is not only in the case of Zimein betachtona, where you designated the bottom story, V'lo Zimein be'elyona, and you didn't designate the top story, U'matza betachtona, and you find two birds on the bottom story on the ledge, V'lo matza, let me just explain this outside. Rav is saying the following, remember, this whole sugya is talking about birds that only hop. They don't yet fly, because if they would actually fly, you wouldn't be allowed to shech them, even if you prepared them, because that would be capturing a wild bird. Now, what Rav is saying is the following. We're dealing with hopping birds, and although you would figure it is easier to hop down something than hop up something, so you might figure like this. When would there be a problem? That's if the bottom nest was mukhan, the top nest was not mukhan, and then I find nothing in the top, and I find two birds on the bottom ledge, so I have to be afraid maybe they hopped down from the top one, because birds could do that. But what if it was the opposite? What if I prepared the top nest, and I didn't prepare the bottom one, and the next day I find the bottom one empty, and two birds in front of the ledge of the top one? Now there you might figure, well, I don't have to be afraid that the ones at the bottom hopped up on the top, because little birds might be able to hop down, but can little birds hop up? So Rava's chiddush is that not only is it going to be forbidden when you prepared the bottom and not the top, and you find birds on the bottom who may have come from the top, will it be forbidden? But even if you prepared the top and didn't prepare the bottom, And when you check the top, you find birds on the ledge on the top. That's also going to be Usser, because we are afraid the birds from the bottom were able to climb up and find their way on the top. That's his chiddush, that the Mishnah Users it even in that case. And he says, lo mi boy, it is obvious. Lo mi boy, meaning it's not necessary to state. It is obvious. If you were zimein betachtona, if you prepared the birds in the lower level, v'lo zimein b'elyona, you did not prepare the birds on the upper level, umatza betachtona, and then you find them, not in the nest, but you find them on the ledge of the bottom, and there's nothing on top, of course that's usher. Why is that usher? D'amrinan, because we say, hanach, those birds in the bottom that you prepared, Azlu li alma, they may have gone away. Vahanach, and these birds on the ledge, each ishtar vuve ishtar vuv, they lowered themselves, vinachis, and came down, because it's clear that birds can climb down. Ella, and that's obvious. Ella, but afilu zimein bielyona, even if you prepared birds on the upper level. V'lo zimein betachton, and you didn't prepare birds on the lower level. And the next day you find two birds on the ledge outside of the upper level. It is still forbidden, because we're afraid they came from the bottom. V'lo mazot tachton, hanach nami yasiri, the amrinan, hanach azlu liyalma, that the birds on top flew away, or climbed away. V'hanach, and these birds at the bottom, Siruche Sarich, they grabbed on to the pole, the Saliku, and they climbed up. They hopped up. I still remember when my son was around, I think he was 1.5. You know, I one time we heard him crying or something. You know, we looked, we went into his room, we looked all over the place, we couldn't find him. He had climbed, it's amazing, he had climbed to the top of a bookcase. Like, you know, you have the crib, and you have a lower bookcase, then you have a higher bookcase. And literally, he got from the crib onto the lower one, and then onto the top. He was like 6 feet or 7 feet above the floor.
How old was he?
He was like 1.5.
Wow.
You know, and but you know, so kids do that. They climb up, but then, you know, it's a little scary. How do you get down? But, so the little bird can do the same thing. Even before it flies, the bird kind of climbs up.
Do you do it again?
He has not done it since, no. Now, it wouldn't, I don't know if it would support his weight. Okay. All right. Now,
a woodpecker can climb a tree.
When you say climb a tree, it just literally puts its claws in the wood, you mean?
I don't know.
I don't know, but, yeah. Okay. Now, then the Mishnah said, the final thing the Mishnah said was that if you find your birds in a different place, but there are no other birds around at all, now we're going to define that term, then it's going to be mutter. In other words, this problem of you find a change in location is only if there were other undesignated birds that could have been. But if all you have are these birds, then wherever they are, they're going to be okay. Now the Gemara is going to explain, let me just mention it outside, that this actually means that there are no hopping birds within 50 amot, 50 cubits of the nest, because our assumption is a bird that is not yet capable of flight will not travel more than 50 cubits from its nest. And therefore, if you designate a bird and there are no other hopping birds, we're not dealing with flying birds, that you could tell, there are no other hopping birds within 50 amos, even if you find the bird in a different place, you're going to be okay, because we assume it got to be that. And now the Gemara explains, Hechi dummy, what do we mean there are no other birds? Ilema b'mefurachin, we cannot be talking about birds that are capable of flying, because what do you mean? No matter how far, I mean, there are always birds could fly hundreds of miles, right? It's always possible that these birds left and these are other birds. Ella b'madadin, right? This is what we've always said. Madadin is we are dealing with birds that do not yet fly, but they hop. They can hop and they can climb. And our general rule is, e deika kain betoch hamishim ama, if they have their nest within a radius of 50 cubits to where your nest is, adude adadu, they can hop. However, e doleka kain betoch hamishim ama, if there is no nest of young hopping birds within 50 cubits of your nest, then even if your bird changed its location, you know, up, down, whatever it would be, it's still considered to be your bird. So the Gemara asks Akasha, this is obvious. Pshita de mutarin. This is obvious that it's mutar. It doesn't even have to be stated. Diamar mar ukva bar chama. Kol hamedada ein madada yoser mechamishim ama. Any hopping of a bird that cannot fly will never be more than 50 amos from its nest. That's like the homing instinct. It will not go more than 50 amos. So why does the Mishnah have to state that if there are no birds within 50 amos, it is permitted? Of course that's the case, because if it's 100 amos away, the bird will not come. So the Gemara's answer is, the Mishnah is a chiddush. Liolam deika kain betoch hamishim ama. The Mishnah is talking about a case where there is a bird's nest within 50 amos of yours. If so, why would it be mutter if I find my birds in a different location? The answer is kegon dekaima bekeren zavis. But the bird cages, the bird nests rather, are positioned on opposite sides of a corner. In other words, they're not visible. Meaning to say, you have a house that in two walls intersect at an angle, and one set of nests are against one side of the house, and the other set of nests are on the other side of the house at an angle, and therefore they are not visible, as the picture says. So the rule, and this is a rule of describing bird behavior, the rule that a bird will wander up to 50 amos is only if its original home is visible to it. It will never move beyond the range of visibility. And therefore, we do not have to assume, remember, this is a non-flying bird. We do not have to assume that a non-flying bird is going to turn a corner. Right? Because if it turns a corner, it's going to lose the visibility of its nest. And that's what the Mishnah means by the phrase, there are no birds other than it, meaning to say, there is no unobstructed nest within 50 amos, even though there is a nest within 50 amos, but it's on the other side of a corner and it could not be seen. That's the chiddush of the Mishnah. Ma'u detema, I might have thought, adu the adadu, perhaps a bird will hop 50 amos, even if it involves turning a corner. Kamash malan, the Mishnah teaches us, kol hecha de madada v'hadr chazel akine. Only if it hops and it can still see its original nest, madada, it will hop. V'yi lo, but if it has to round a corner and lose sight of its original nest, lo madada, it will not hop. Okay, but again, the particular concept here is not a difficult concept. The concept basically is, you must designate your birds. And if there's any reasonable fear that the birds that you find are not the birds that you designated, you will not be allowed to shech them on Yom Tov. Okay. Now we go back to another Mishnah. Now remember, we actually had virtually every Mishnah we're going to have in the first parak we had already. Remember, the Gemara was going through all the machloks in Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, and it mentioned all of these Mishnayos. So this is a Mishnah that we mentioned before, but now we're going to go into it in more detail. And the whole first parak of Be'a are the machloksim of Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel regarding the laws of Shabbos. And it says, Beis Shammai Omrim, Beis Shammai says, Ein notlin es ha'oli l'katsev alav basor. On Yom Tov, you do not take a pestle. Pestle is when you pound spices or pound grain. It is the pounder. Now, the pounder in those days was not rounded like we have it. It tended to be a square block. So imagine this as a square block of wood. So you could actually use it as a cutting board. It was big and wide enough that you could cut meat on it. Now, here is the underlying assumption that Beis Shammai is making. Beis Shammai is making the assumption that the normal use of the ali, of the pestle, is to pound and crush grain. Now, you're not allowed to crush grain on Shabbos or Yom Tov, because that is a molacha that is called tochein, grinding. But you can't make flour. Even on Yom Tov, you can cook and the like, but you cannot grind and make flour. Therefore, the eli is what we call in halacha kli shemolachto li'iser. It is a utensil whose normal purpose is to do something that is forbidden on Shabbos. A pen is that way, a pen, a pencil. Now the question is, and that's a form of muktzah, because it is a vessel whose use on Shabbos and Yom Tov is a prohibited use, so you're not even supposed to move it. But here is the question. If I want to take a vessel whose use is impermissible, but I want to use it for a permissible purpose, am I allowed to do that?
Is that using a hammer to crack nuts?
That's correct. Exactly right. Yeah. Now, the example that the Mishnah gives is, can I use the pestle that is normally used to crush grain? Can I use it as a cutting board to cut meat, which is permitted, of course, on Shabbos and Yom Tov? Beis Shammai is strict. Beis Shammai says, vessels whose purpose is forbidden melacha cannot be used even for a permissible purpose. That's what Beis Shammai says. Beis Hillel, however, matirin. Now again, this is a principle of very wide application. Like you said, a hammer is kli shemalachto li'iser, because normally you use hammers for building, which you cannot do. But if you want to use a hammer to crack a nut, Beis Shammai would say, not allowed. Beis Hillel would say, you are allowed. If I want to use a pen as a bookmark, can I move a pen if I want to use it as a bookmark? Beis Shammai would say no. Beis Hillel would say yes. You can actually use a pen, not an expensive pen for other reasons, but you could certainly use cheap pens for a bookmark and the like. This is called kli shemalachto li'iser. Now, what can't you move a pen for? Or the eli for? You cannot move the eli or the pen for its own protection. Let's assume that you left your pen out in the rain or something, and you're concerned it'll get ruined. That you're not allowed to do. So you can move it if you want to use it. So of course, the simple solution would be, we would tell you, you know, we really don't care what your subjective motive is. In other words, even if you're making up a purpose, we would tell you, use the pen for a bookmark. And even though your real intention is to get it out of the rain, but you're allowed to do that as long as you actually use it for a bookmark. Or if your hammer, you're afraid your hammer is going to rust, although hammers today will not rust, but let's assume you have a tool that will rust, so you could use it to crack a nut or something like that. Okay. Alright, so that's the first machlokas, Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. Now we have a second machlokas. Beis Shammai Omrim. Ein, again, we had this before as well. Ein nosnin es ha'or lifnei hador son. Now, you're allowed to slaughter an animal on Yom Tov because you're allowed to kill for food preparation. Not on Shabbos, but on Yom Tov, you can slaughter an animal. But here's the problem. When you slaughter an animal to get the meat, you also have to skin the animal. Obviously, you got to remove the hide. But what do you do with the hide? The hide itself is considered to be muktzah, because until it is processed, and you're not allowed to process it, it is not considered usable for a garment. So therefore, Beis Shammai says, you cannot put the hide on the threshold of your house. Now, why would you want to do that? Because one of the ways you process a hide is by beating it. That softens the connective tissue and the like. So now you're not allowed to do that because that's called a malacha of ibud, processing hide. But can you do it indirectly? Can I put it like a welcome mat in front of my door? So every time people are walking over my door, they're pounding the hide. So Beis Shammai says, you cannot do that because indirectly, that is processing hide, which you're not allowed to do. So he says, you are not allowed to put hide on your threshold to be trampled, because that's a forbidden malacha. And then he says even further, v'lo yad bihenu. And you're not even allowed to move the hide. again, it's kind of messy. In the middle of your kitchen, you have this whole animal hide. You cannot move it because it's mukta. But he does give you a way out. Ela im kein yesh imo kizayis basar. If on the hide there is still an olive size volume of a piece of meat, in other words, if the hide is still connected to some meat, so it becomes the protective cover of the meat, so you can move the whole thing. Which means, in other words, functionally, all this means is that when you skin an animal on Yom Tov, if you want to be able to put away the hide, just be sure to leave a piece of meat on the hide, and that will allow you to do it, because it is Beis Shammai's opinion that once all meat has been removed from the hide is now muktza and cannot be handled at all. That's Beis Shammai's opinion. But again, that's a pretty simple solution, basically. Just leave a piece of meat when you skin it. A kazayas is not very big. It's the volume of an olive. And even though some say the olives today are only 50%, so it's the volume of two olives, but it still doesn't have to be, it's not a gigantic amount. Of course, olives have so many sizes, right? Olives have like 10 sizes. All of them are hyperbole. I think the smallest olive is jumbo or something. You know, they start with some real large size and they get super. Okay.
May I just ask a tangential question?
Yep.
With the matter of the hammer, if one intends to use the hammer and moves it but doesn't use it, is that...
You change your mind, you mean?
You were distracted, something happened.
If you moved it with the proper motivation... So
the intent.
That's what we're looking at. Yeah.
Good. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Now, Beis Hillel Matirin. Beis Hillel, it seems to me he permits both things. Beis Hillel permits both practices. He permits you to put the hide on the threshold of your doorway. And he permits, but these concepts are really two different concepts. They're not really the same problem. Putting the hide in the doorway is a problem that you're actually causing a malacha to be done. That's a different issue. The other issue is simply an issue of mukta, of moving a mukta object. And in both of these cases, Beis Hillel is mekel, even though these are really, I think, two unrelated leniencies. One is to put the hide in front of your doorway to be trampled, and the other is moving the hide without leaving a kazayas of meat on it. And once again, this is an example of Beis Hillel being more lenient in the laws of Yom Tov than Beis Shammai. Okay, but we will explain, the Gemara will explain different arguments here.
Normal walking, is that considered a melacha?
Normal walking, no. As long as you don't go more than 2,000 cubits from your city. I mean, you can't walk 20 miles. Well, let me put it this way. As long as you have continuous houses, you can walk as far as you can walk 10 miles. There's no problem with that. But once you get into open country, you can only go 2,000 cubits, which is around a kilometer. You're actually not allowed to walk more than that kilometer on Shabbos or Yom Tov.
So stamping on meat at the door is melacha.
Well, it's not stamping on meat. It's stamping on hide.
Oh,
hide.
Right.
No, that's very different.
Right.
Stamping on meat is not a melacha. Although I don't know, I mean, I wouldn't want to eat it, but it's not a malacha. But stamping on hide is a malacha because one of the prohibited malachot is processing hide.
Right.
To make it suitable for garments. And therefore, anything that softens the hide, like tannery, the tanning procedures for leather is a malacha. So Beis Shammai prohibits this because this is indirectly preparing the ore. Why Beis Hillel permits it is not entirely clear. I mean, I understand that the mukta thing he could be lenient on. It's not clear about the malacha thing, why he would allow that to be done. Because the shayla is, it seems to be an issur d'oraisa, so it's not clear how he gets around that. Okay. All right, so these are the two areas of disagreement. One is the movement of the pestle in order to use as a cutting board, and the other is the treatment of hide when you slaughter the animal. Now, The Mishnah now reverts back to the first case, which is the use of the pestle, the pounder, as a cutting board. So Tana, we did learn in a brisa, vishavin, they are equal. Both Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel agree. In other words, even Beis Hillel, who is lenient and allows you to use the pestle as a cutting board, im katsav alav basor, once you cut your meat, once you've finished your task, asur letaltalo, it is forbidden to move it. In other words, the point that the Gemara is making is a very important point. It's not that Beis Hillel disagrees that this pestle is muktzah. He admits that a kli shemalachto liyisur is muktzah, but he allows the muktzah to be overridden by a permissible use. But once you have finished your permissible use and you have no other use for it, you are not allowed to move it. In other words, this is an important point because you might have understood Beis Hillel to say that it's not muktzah at all. Right? And that's what the Braisa is negating. Okay. Now we have a new thing. Amar Abaye wants to say, Machlokes, the argument between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel is Bieli. Eli is the pestle. Aval b'tavra garmi. Now tavra garmi, tavra is Aramaic for shover, the tuff and the shin. Garmi are bones. This is a meat cleaver. A meat cleaver that actually cuts through bones. A big cleaver that cuts through bones. So divri akol mutter. In other words, Beis Shammai is arguing about a pestle that is used for pounding grain. But a meat cleaver that is used for cutting through bones, you're certainly allowed to cut meat. Now the Gemara is going to ask, that's obvious, because a meat cleaver is not a prohibited, it's not a kli shemalachto liyisur, it's used for cutting meat and cutting bone, which you're allowed to do. So why would you think Beis Shammai would prohibit it? Right, so the Gemara asks, Pshita, isn't Abaye's point obvious? Eli Tanan, the Mishnah talks about a pestle that is used for pounding grain. It does not talk about a meat cleaver that's used to break bones. The answer is no. Mahu detema, I might have thought in Beis Shammai, right? I might have thought in Beis Shammai, hu hadin, the same law is true, afilu tavra garmi nami, even for a meat cleaver. Now, I'll say why in a moment. So why does it say a pestle? Fahai diktani eli lo diacha. In other words, like this. The eli, the pestle, is called a kli shemalachto le'iser because its normal function is prohibited work, pounding grain. A tavra garmi is a kli shemalachto leheter because its normal function is permissible. So what the Gemara is saying is, I might have thought that Beis Shammai even asers the permissible vessel. Hold off why that's so. And why does the Mishnah give me the case of the impermissible vessel? To teach me that Beis Hillel is lenient even on the impermissible. Which would mean, in other words, Beis Hillel is lenient even on the impermissible, but Beis Shammai might be strict even on the permissible. Kamash Malan, no, that Beis Shammai would also be lenient on the permissible. Now, the question is, of course, under what possible logic, why would Beis Shammai forbid a meat cleaver? In other words, the issue of the pestle is because it's a utensil whose function is normally to do things that are forbidden. But why, in other words, why would I have thought that Beis Shammai asers a meat cleaver? And not only that, but let's go a little further. There's an Ika Diamri, there is a second Lashon in the Gemara, a second version of Abaye, where in fact Beis Shammai does aser a meat cleaver. This is even a bigger question. Amar Abaye,
this is commercial meat cleaver. I don't know. Big.
Well, we'll see in a second. La nitzrucha el afilu tavra garmi chadati. Now, okay, we'll come back to that. Now, what does Rashi say here? Rashi says, Well, Rashi's explanation is a meat cleaver is a permissible vessel, but it's a big, heavy, cumbersome type of thing. And sometimes a person decides that it's too exhausting to use. And therefore, there's a chashash, perhaps Beis Shammai is afraid, that after you schlep this thing, you'll decide not to use it. And he didn't want you to go through the physical exertion of schlepping it. Now, this is a supposition. So there might have been some reason where Beis Shammai would actually say it's forbidden. But that's all, remember, this is all a hypothetical possibility. But the chiddush of Abaye is, no, Beis Shammai does not aser meat cleavers. He only asers pestles that are kli shemalachto liyisr. Now, let's look at the second. But now we have an alternative version of Abaye. Ika d'amri. Some people say, Amar Abaye, that Abaye says, Lai nitzricha ela afilu tavra garme chadati. Now, this is a new thing. Beis Shammai prohibits not only a pestle, he prohibits even a meat cleaver, but only if it's chadati. Chadati is Aramaic for chadash, a new meat cleaver that was never used before. So here, Beis Shammai's argument is, once again, since it's new, right, this is often, right, in other words, you schlep this big, heavy thing, but it's so new and shiny and sharp that you figure you don't want to, you may not want to use it right now. Right, often we don't like to use things for the first time because we don't want to ruin it. And therefore, Beis Shammai asers it because we're choshesh, you'll change your mind. And then it turned out you engaged in what? Unnecessary, superfluous exertion on Yom Tov. Ma'o detema, I might have thought, mimlach, one second, the line is one second. Is this saying Beis Shammai asers or Beis Shammai doesn't answer? One second, how are we learning this? Yeah, the Gemara's lashon here is a little convoluted. One second. The way Rashi understands the Ika d'Amri, it's a little different than the way we would normally translate it. See, the way you normally translate this line of Gemara is, Abaye is telling me what Beis Shammai prohibits. That Beis Shammai prohibits a new meat cleaver. That's what this line would normally mean. But that's not the way Rashi learns. Rashi learns that what Beis Shammai is negating and saying that is not usher is even a new meat cleaver. That even a new meat cleaver, where there's more of a reason to be afraid, you will change your mind, Beis Shammai still permits. In other words, Beis Shammai permits it, even though it's a new meat cleaver. So now the Gemara asks the Kasha, Ubei Shammai lo chayshi liyamluche? Are you telling me Beis Shammai is not concerned for people changing their mind? Meaning, he's not afraid you'll change your mind. For Asanya, we learned in the following brisa, Beis Shammai omrim, Beis Shammai says, Ein molichin tabach v'sakin etzel behema, v'lo behema etzel tabach v'sakin. Yeah, it's hard to understand exactly what this means. What this says is the following. On Yom Tov, you're allowed to shecht, right? That's a given. But let's assume that you have an animal in your house and you have to bring it to a shochet. You're not a shochet yourself. You have to bring an animal to the shochet. Or either you bring the animal to the shochet or you bring the shochet to the animal. Beis Shammai says, if you have to bring the shochet to the animal, or the animal to the shochet, you do not shecht on Yom Tov, because we are afraid that the unnecessary exertion of transportation of animal or walking over the shochet, you might change your mind the last second and it becomes unnecessary exertion. Which means, according to Beis Shammai, when would you be allowed to shecht? Only if you are a shochet with an animal in your house already. But you would not... I mean, again, it's hard to know. Is there any particular limit? What if my next-door neighbor is a shochet? I'm not sure exactly what distance Beis Shammai is concerned about as being unnecessary exertion. He really does not quantify it. But he says, but literally he says, we don't bring the shochet to the animal, nor do we bring the animal to the shochet, because we are concerned with a change of mind, which retroactively means you were engaged in unnecessary exertion. That's what Beis Shammai says. Beis Hillel omrim, molichin zeh etzel zeh. No problem, you can bring the shochet to the animal, or the animal to the shochet. Well, Beis Shammai has no problem because he says the alternative would be that people would find it difficult to slaughter animals on Yom Tov, and this would affect adversely their enjoyment of the Yom Tov.
Beis Hillel also, though.
This is Beis Hillel. And as Beis Hillel basically says, we are not going to impose restrictions on activities that you might change your mind for if to prohibit those activities would diminish your joy of the holiday. That's Beis Hillel. Similarly, Beis Shammai Omrim, Ein Molichin Tavlin Umadoch Eitzel Meduche. Let's say you have spices, and a Madoch is a pounder. Now again, this is an interesting question. On one hand, let me just go over the halachas here for a moment. On one hand, the Mishnah clearly indicated that a grain pounding pestle is a pounding grain is forbidden on Yom Tov. And yet, pounding spices to crush them up is actually permitted on Yom Tov. That's a Mishnah we had before. And just to tell people, just to remind people, what is the difference? Why is it indeed forbidden to pound grain for flour, but it's permissible to grind pepper? And the difference is, the basic difference is, that spices lose their taste relatively rapidly after they are ground. And therefore, it's something that you really couldn't have done before Yom Tov with the same quality. So you're allowed to grind spices on Yom Tov because doing it beforehand would compromise their quality. As opposed to grain, make flour before Yom Tov is just as good as flour on Yom Tov. There's no advantage to freshly ground flour, right? You never, you know, I hear advertisements for freshly ground coffee, but you never hear a bakery say, you know, we have freshly ground flour. And therefore, the grinding of flour is not permitted on Yom Tov. Okay? And that's a given. But, so let's say you have spices, so and you have a pestle, you have a pounder, but you don't have the bowl. You have to go to a next-door neighbor for a bowl. So even that, Beis Shammai says, you don't bring the spices and the pounder to the pounding bowl, and you don't bring the pounding bowl to the tavlin and the madoch, because again, it's very hard to quantify this. Again, I mean, what's the problem with the next door neighbor? How hard is it to borrow a bowl? But the point is, Beis Shammai is very concerned with the idea that people change their minds, and therefore they are involved in exertion. Beis Hillel, of course, has no particular problem. Molichin zeh eitzel zeh. Now, what is the Gemara's problem? The Gemara's problem is the following. Abaye has told me that Beis Shammai only prohibits moving the grain pounder as a cutting board, because that's a klisha malach doli yisr, but a meat cleaver, which is a big, heavy, schleppy thing, that he could move, and you can use it to cut meat. And we're not afraid, even in Beis Shammai, we're not afraid he's going to change his mind and retrospectively he was engaged in unnecessary exertion. That's what Abaye says. Frek de Gemara Akasha, the Gemara Sakasha, we see that Beis Shammai is very concerned with people changing their mind. Because he says you don't bring the animal to the shochet, you don't bring the shochet to the animal. So the same logic should say you're not allowed to take out your big, heavy meat cleaver. So it's a contradiction.
Do you have a definition of, or do they offer a definition of unnecessary exertion?
No, it actually is a very nebulous idea. I'm suggesting, at least in the case of the meat cleaver, that the unnecessary exertion stems from the heavy, cumbersome nature of it. But we don't have precise definitions. Is it 10 pounds? Is it 20 pounds? You know, over how long a distance? How long a time? It is a very nebulous concept.
From person to person.
Well, yeah. Once again, well, theoretically, but practically, you couldn't have a halacha that way. You couldn't say, you know, strong guy, you can do up to 100 pounds. You know, weak guy, 10 pounds. You know, we're not going to. You're not going to have a system that's based on each person as a separate halacha.
So, is the source of the exertion restriction?
Well, it's Drabbanan, it's not the Oraisa, but it's based on the idea that since Yom Tov and Shabbos are days of rest, so the Chachamim, even beyond the Malacha, there is a general body of principles that try to say to avoid unnecessary exertion. But as I say, it's not quantified. I mean, people do all sorts of things. People set up tables for Shalosh Shudas. I mean, people do many things that are physically hard. So there is
but
no...
unnecessary.
Well, unnecessary, okay.
But that...
Then it becomes necessary, okay. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, but my question is, what is permissible and necessary exertion?
Well, certainly exertion in order to cook food on Yom Tov is permissible. But Beis Shammai is introducing the idea that something that was necessary for what you were going to do may become unnecessary by virtue of your change of mind. Now, that's Beis Shammai's concept here, meaning to move it to cut the meat. If you knew with 100% prediction that you were going to cut the meat, go ahead. But the problem is, Beis Shammai is afraid you might change your mind, and his chiddush is, this is a chiddush, that an activity that was undertaken as necessary for a certain result turns into unnecessary labor when that result is not pursued.
So planning is important.
Well, not only planning is important, but there's also, even if you plan, it's going to be forbidden because you're not going to execute it. Right. That's his problem. So the question is, why is bringing the animal to the shochet, which Beis Shammai says is usher, and yet you can cut the meat with your meat cleaver? Right? What's the difference there? So the Gemara says there is a difference in terms of the probability of changing your mind. There's a probability issue here. And he says the following. Hachi hashta, behold now, bishlama behema, when I take an animal to a shochet, or I bring a shochet to an animal, asi liam luche, people can change their minds. Why would they change their minds? Diamar, a person might say at the last minute, nishbay kai behema kachusha. In other words, a person might look at an animal, and when the shochet comes there, the shochet may give him a professional judgment. This animal will only feed 10 people. And then you realize you got 20 guests. So you might figure, let's put this animal away, let's go to the corral, let's schlep another animal, etc. So there'll be a whole bunch of tircha that can come. Mycina behema charite, the shmeina mina, kadei renami. With spices, it's the same thing. In other words, this is going on the second ruling, that you don't bring the spices to the bowl or the bowl to the spices because we're afraid you'll change your mind. Because when you have a pot of soup that you want to put the spices in, asiliam luche, a person might change his mind. Diamar, nishbay kai kadeira, let us forget about this pot of soup, the boy tavlin that needs spices. Let's eat something else that doesn't need spices. In other words, you could change your mind. You could grind up a whole bunch of basil and then decide, I'll go with the one that doesn't have the basil. I'll go with something else. In other words, changing of mind. There is the possibility of changing of mind. Ah, what about a meat cleaver? Huh? Okay, let me just explain it outside. In other words, the answer is basically very simple. His answer is, you might change your mind before you kill the animal or before you grind the spices. But once you have a slaughtered animal with meat, and particularly when you didn't have refrigeration, there is no chashash that you will decide not to cut up the meat. Once the meat is dead, you will definitely cut it up and eat it, because otherwise it's going to spoil. So therefore, the concern that you'll schlep the meat cleaver and decide not to cut the meat is a very minimal, improbable concern, because you may decide not to slaughter the animal, but once the animal is slaughtered, you will certainly cut up the meat. And therefore, that is why Beis Shammai permits the meat cleaver, although he does prohibit the pestle, because it's kli shemalachto liyisr. That's a separate concern. And that's what the Gemara says. Hacha, in the case of a slaughtered animal, mai ika lememar, what will you say? Mimlach, he will change his mind. V'loi tavar, and he will not slaughter the animal. I'm sorry, he will not cut up the meat. Kivan deshachta, once the animal was slaughtered, litavira kaima, it is there to be broken up. Again, you could question whether in a time of refrigeration things might be different, but at least in the time of the Mishnah, I mean, we don't pass like Beis Shammai anyway, see. We don't have any concern at all for this, but even like Beis Shammai, perhaps when there's refrigeration, things might be different. When there's no refrigeration, you kind of have to use the meat right away, and therefore we are not afraid you're going to change your mind and decide not to cut up the meat for consumption. Okay, let's do just a few more lines. I'm sorry.
Would it make a difference if one understands Tavra Garmi differently? Steinsaltz says it's sadan, the sadan on which one breaks the bones.
Mm-hmm. That's fine. That actually heavier. It's heavier. That also has an advantage of symmetry. In fact, this was bothering me. I'm glad that he says that, because what bothered me is the eli is being used as a cutting board, and the tavra garmi, if it was a meat cleaver, I mean, you're kind of comparing the board and the knife. The way he's doing it is he's dealing with two cutting board surfaces, so that has a good advantage of comparing the eli as a cutting board versus the anvil as a cutting board. I think that's a very good pshat, but it doesn't change anything. In other words, it adds to the idea of changing your mind, because it's a big, heavy thing. Of course, you might think, once you've schlepped a big, heavy thing, maybe you bedavka don't want to change your mind, because you've said, hey, I schlepped it, I'm not going to schlep it for nothing. We're going to use it no matter what. But there is a fear that you might decide. But the Gemara says, basically, that for meat, you're not going to change your mind, because it's going to spoil. Yeah, but I think that's good. Tavra garmi, that actually makes sense. I don't know if Rashi says that beferish. Well, tavra garmi miuchedes lekatsev aleha. Yeah, the Rashi implies that way, that you cut meat on it. Yeah. Now we then come to the next issue of what do you do with hide when you skin an animal? So Beis Shammai says you can put the hide on the doorway for people to trample on. And I'm sorry. Beis Shammai says you cannot. Nor can you even move the hide unless there's a kazayas of basar. And Beis Hillel permits both of those practices. So now the Gemara brings a brisa. Tana. We learn in a brisa. Vishavin, both agree you can do the following. Mochin alav basar. Let me explain a little background here. This is actually among many modern kashrus observing Jews, this is almost a forgotten mitzvah because it's done by the butchers today. But we know that when you have meat, you're obligated to salt meat before you can eat it, and the reason is because meat contains blood, and the salt draws out the blood. And you cannot eat the meat until the blood has been removed by the proper salting procedure. Today, most meat we don't have to salt because the butchers do it for us. But you know, it's a fairly recent phenomenon. I mean, I'm sure you remember when meat was not salted. Yeah. I remember it as well. You had to salt your own meat and the like. Now, the one exception to the salting rule is liver. And that is the following problem. The liver is an organ that is so considered to be so suffused with blood that even if you salt it, it does not take out all of the blood. And that is why liver can only be eaten through a process of broiling. See, broiling, technically you don't need to salt meat because the broiling is the heat. The dry heat draws out all of the blood. Now, even liver, however, is salted a little bit. It is not salted to the same extent. So consequently, we have two categories of salting. We have the extreme salting that you need in order to cook meat in a pot when you're not broiling it. That's when you cover it totally in salt and then wash it away. But then there is the smaller amount of salt that you use for broiling. By the way, it's lav dafka liver. In other words, any meat that you broil, I mean, you can decide if you broil a steak, you don't have to salt it like you would salt meat like a pot roast, but you salt it a little bit. So consequently, we describe two types of salting: malicha for tzali, which is minimal, and malicha for kedera, malicha for pot roast, which requires a full malicha and the like. Now, here is the problem. We're going to have a similar problem to putting the ore on the threshold, and that is one of the ways you process hide is by coating it with salt. So here is the question. Are you allowed to use the animal hide on Yom Tov and salt your meat on it? Because indirectly, it's the same type of problem, you're tanning the leather. So here the Braisa says, you might assume that this should be the same argument between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. Beis Shammai says you're not allowed to put the hide on the threshold to be trampled because indirectly you're processing the leather. By the same token, you shouldn't be allowed to salt meat on the leather. Beis Hillel, who permits that indirect processing, might do the same thing. In other words, you might assume that the problem of salting meat on top of the leather is identical to the issue of putting the leather in front of your door. The Braisa says no. The Braisa says, Vishavin, both Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel admit, Shemolchin alav basar litzli. You can salt meat on top of the leather, but only if you're doing it for broiling and not pot cooking. In other words, the concept here is...
Salt is roasting, isn't it?
Well, broiling, roasting and broiling. Yeah, roasting and broiling are the same. It's a dry heat either above or below. Now, here is the thing. The reason is because the amount of salt that you use in tzli is relatively small, so it really does not process the leather. And that's what Abaye adds. Omer Abaye adds, Loishanu elo litzli. It is only permitted to salt the leather, salt the meat on the leather, if you're doing it in the quantities that you use for broiling or roasting, which are normally small quantities. Aval likedera, but if you're salting the meat to the degree that you need when you're going to do pot cooking, which is very extensive, lo, that is forbidden because, well, again, what's interesting is you could ask this question. When it says it's forbidden, does it mean it's forbidden like everybody, or it's forbidden like Beis Shammai? See that's a question. Because Abaye was trying to say that Tzli is much like Beis Shammai, but Kedera is Usser. Usser le divrei akol, or Usser like Beis Shammai? Yeah, that's a question. But the Gemara asks, Pshita, what is Abaye's point? Of course, only Tzli is permitted, because it says Tzli. That's why it says, Molchan alev basar le Tzli, for roasting. Right, so what's Abaye's Chiddush? The Chiddush is, HaKamash Malan, Abaye means to emphasize, Afilu Litzli Ke'ein Kederas. In other words, here is the point. Theoretically, if a person likes salt, you are permitted to put, to put the same amount of salt on roasted meat that you would put on pot meat. So Abaye is making the point that it's not a question of how you want to cook the meat. In other words, it's not that salting for roasting is okay no matter how much salt you put on it. Rather, it's the question of the amount of salt. So if it's tzli, if you're putting on the roasted meat, or the meat to be, actually it's the meat to be roasted, the same amount of salt you would put on a pot roast, then you're not allowed to do that. Okay, that's what he's saying. That it's not a question of tzli versus cooking, It's a question of quantity of salt, small quantity versus large quantity. Okay? All right, we'll stop here.